Gosh, the lemongrass is huge. All of these weird little stamens in them as well. Hey, Oliver, what's going on, dude? He's a very talkative boy. The classic sounds of Houston. It's always under construction.
Most environmental shows start with a dramatic landscape or a plunge into the depths of the ocean. And that's why I'm going to start in my driveway.
This is a very, very un-British thing to have this sort of corrugated iron roof that protects your car from the worst of the weather.
Then there's a close-up of some coral or a bird in a tree, but I'm going to do a close-up on a feeling. It's a feeling of doom mixed with guilt. See? We're off to a jolly start already.
A major new report has scientifically linked more storms, floods, droughts, heat waves and other extreme weather events to global warming.
70,000 fires in Brazil.
The climate change issue is an absolutely catastrophic, nightmarish mess.
I'm a depression sufferer. It flared up really bad about 6 years ago. Depression's horrible because it makes your awareness cone down into a tiny, tiny little reference frame, like having blinkers on. And so at the very worst moment of this year-long depressive episode, I could only really think 5 minutes into the future and 5 minutes into the past. And when it's like that, it's like being, you know, a frightened cat, right? Like everything frightens you and overwhelms you and you just want to run from everything. Everything's too stimulating.
People are suffering. People are dying.
Our civilization is being sacrificed.
I wouldn't blame you if you feel like curling up in the fetal position and crying when you hear stuff like that, because I do. And I think that's a perfectly realistic, accurate response to it, to be honest with you.
Our house is on fire.
And things are only going to get worse.
Don't worry, we're not going to be bombarding you like this all the time. Actually, that's what I hate about a lot of these shows. They just sort of slap you upside the head with all the bad stuff and just leave you at the shock place or the guilt place, like feeling like everything that you do or most things that you do are really evil. We're not going to do that. We're going to try to explore inside those feelings and what is it really about and how can we transcend those sorts of feelings and experiences and thoughts so we can get on with something better for ourselves and other life forms.
I've been thinking and writing about this stuff a lot over the last decade or so. I work as an English literature professor in Houston, fossil fuel central. Yet at the same time, I live in a society that's had its head in the sand about the obvious climate crisis. Why has this strange cognitive dissonance happened? And how might we get to a better place?
Because we've got to go through it, because, you know, dolphins don't have fingers with which to switch off the oil pipes. They can't hit shutdown and phone the Apple store. We've got to do it. It's on us. But the trouble is, this is actually fetal position time. If anything's going to shock you, then mass extinction could be it.
We tend to think of the climate crisis as this impending disaster, but we already live in an age of mass extinction caused by global warming. In a way, the end of the world, as we thought we knew it, has already happened.
Just even describing it into a mic to myself makes me feel really triggered, to be honest with you. I can only just about do this, and I feel like most of us, including me, are basically like deer in the headlights of this oncoming global warming situation. And I don't know, I'm scared and I'm shocked and I'm pretty traumatized. And I think that everybody is really. It's just varying degrees of admitting to it.
What do I do when I feel like this? I talk to a professional.
Can you explain some different ways in which we sort of defend against that trauma?
There are lots of different defenses against trauma.
Caroline Hickman is a psychotherapist and member of the not-for-profit NGO, the Climate Psychology Alliance.
There's the whole defence of denial, so we're saying, no, this isn't really happening. You can split, so with one part of your mind, you kind of half believe it, but with another part of your mind, you completely disbelieve it, and you move between them. So one minute you sort of think, well, maybe it is real, and the next minute you think, no, it can't possibly be. And those two can't find their way to come together. We need to be really, really kind about our defences, because the thing about defences is they're there for a reason. We develop them to survive. But in the longer term, they serve to act against us, and they prevent us from encountering truths. That may be in our personal life. It may be a defence against the realities of the trauma and the fear and the terror that's evoked when people think about the climate and biodiversity crisis. And one of the first things people think is it's not really happening. And if it was really happening, then everyone would be running around panicking. Well, if they're not running around panicking, then it can't really be happening.
There's been quite a bit more coverage of ecological news of late, but I can't help feeling pretty anxious about the way that this is happening.
25% of all of the animals on Earth.
1 million species could go extinct.
Because now everybody thinks they know how to write an eco-shock piece and that that's what they should be doing. They should be headless chickening. Let's see this. Here's one. Greenland on track to lose 440 billion tonnes of ice. It's a huge, terrifying, yet also terrifyingly meaningless number. Associated Press News. Best way to fight climate change? Plant a trillion trees. Oh, great, let's plant a trillion trees, let's do that. Who's up for that? Let's do it this afternoon. It's incredibly implausible, amazing utopian solutions to things that involve doing something very simple, but then you do that something very simple on a scale that's like billions and trillions. You know, if we all just blew our noses on this one particular day, then crocodiles would benefit from having extra slices of birthday cake in the Amazon. And again, you just feel really powerless.
I would add one other mode, and that's the sort of technocratic savior mode. you know, it's just like, oh, don't worry, because human innovation will totally solve this problem. And, you know, we can geoengineer our way out of it, or we can carbon capture our way out of it. Amy Westervelt, I'm a climate reporter in California. So, yeah, I think is particularly unhelpful, too, although it tends to make people feel better than, you know, you're stupid or you're bad.
I wanted to find out from someone like Amy, who's been on the inside of the media industry, why it is that the climate crisis has been framed in the way it has.
I've been a climate journalist for about 20 years. I've worked for The Guardian, The Washington Post, The New York Times, The Wall Street Journal.
The experience of working with lots of different types of editors, and they do tend to break down to either a preference for kind of doomsday coverage or this like technocratic savior coverage. And I don't think it's a coincidence that they all happen to be white men too. Maybe it's come from playing too many video games.
So it's sort of this epic saga in which they're the heroes. It's like an apocalyptic sci-fi video game or a movie in which a few good men will just get rid of the bad guys in the third act. So there's no need to dismantle patriarchy or white supremacy or envision a different and better way of living or rethink economic and societal structures.
It's very much this doomsday, and then maybe there's this technocratic solve. And, you know, those are narratives that tend to keep the sort of patriarchal paradigm in place. I think bringing in different perspectives from different people would vastly improve how the topic is covered and just people's understanding.
Absolutely. A lot of this is simply white boys like me beginning to go through 1% of the experiences that everybody else is already going through on this planet.
Yeah.
And then going, oh my God, not this. And then I firmly also think that the struggles against racism and misogyny would get us to connect to the coral, as it were, much
yes.
more quickly than just pointing at the coral and saying, connect to it, for goodness sake.
Yeah.
Are there any different kinds of journalism happening now that we could imitate or build on?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I'm seeing a lot more personal essays about climate change. You are starting to see a lot of different audio journalism. So I do think that there are ways that people are using storytelling to kind of break through some of these calcified barriers that people have in their brains about climate change.
An hour's drive east of where I live in Houston, along what's known as the Chemical Coast, is the town of Port Arthur. It's home to several major petrochemical plants, including the largest oil refinery in North America. In the children's playground in the West End district, flaring smokestacks loom over the climbing frame. Hazardous waste facilities sit just yards from residents' bungalows. Asthma and cancer rates are among the highest in Texas, while household incomes are well below the state average.
These railroad tracks literally used to divide black from white.
Hilton Kelly was born and raised here. After decades spent away in the Navy and as a stuntman in California, he returned to his childhood hometown 20 years ago on a mission, campaigning for environmental justice in the area.
The big oil boom happened here like in 1901. When it comes to African Americans, many people flocked here from Mississippi, Alabama, Louisiana, looking for a better way of life. And they packed us all on the west end of town where these industries were growing. And many of us still live there today.
When we were little kids, our apartment was right up in here, yeah, about one or two rows back. Yeah. And we used to look at these industries, yeah, and we used to say, wow, it looked like New York City.
Right.
You know?
Yes, yes.
Because at night it has all, it's pretty
totally,
at night.
It's uncanny because you've got these towers and lights. And
exactly.
It has a certain weird, strange beauty.
It's really sad that the ones that benefit the less from these industries have to bear the brunt of what they're processing. And you see a large number of people in those populations ill with respiratory problems, cancer, and other diseases that are directly connected.
That's right.
That's okay. The air get to you and do that to you.
Anglos created the industries that dump tons and tons of emissions like carbon dioxide, carbon monoxide, benzene, 1,3-butadiene, all these known carcinogens into the air, all in the name of fossil fuels. And most of the people that have created these industries, they live in really, really great environments where there's lakes and rivers and plush green grass. My community should be just as clean as your community. Your industries, why don't you take them with you? Put them next to your homes. But no, they want to come here, do their business here, dump on us, and then go back to the clean suburbs. And most of the time, what you find, the disparity between the half and the have-nots, it's a color barrier. It's years and years of systemic racism that keep people divided. That's it.
2007, they had a huge explosion over here, and the wind was very, very low. It wasn't blowing that hard. And all the smoke, the humidity was heavy, and the smoke just sort of oozed over that barrier right into this community, and it looked like a fog bank was sitting over this area. I know so many people that have died from cancer. It's ridiculous. I've gone to so many funerals, I don't even go into them anymore.
When I hear stories like Hilton's, I get pretty disturbed and moved. Like, what's the point? Does anything mean anything if we're all going extinct? And how does little me go up against some mega oil corporation anyway? If we're going to talk about climate crisis in this more personal way, and hearing perspectives we don't usually hear, we're going to have to get friendly with these responsive feelings rather than hitting delete. Caroline Hickman.
You don't necessarily want to be completely immersed to the point where you can't function. But it's important to touch it, and it's important to let it touch you and to touch that suffering and to not step away from the emotions that it brings to you, such as grief and loss and despair and horror and rage and anger and depression. And we have this incredible dilemma in front of us at the moment as a human species. If we're going to wake up and start to deal with the things that we need to deal with, then we need to feel these feelings, and they will inform us rather than push them away because we're terrified of them.
I'm constantly reminded when you talk about one of my favourite philosophy-type people, Theodore Adorno, says that Proust destroys the aristocracy with remorseless gentleness.
I love the way you put that. It reminds me of the idea that you should always approach defences kindly and warmly and gently, approach from the side and kind of throw messages over the wall until the doors get open to you. I mean, if you just do a sort of full frontal assault on a defended castle, then, you know, the moat is going to be full of crocodiles and there'll be attack dogs and boiling oil coming on your head within seconds. So it's probably not going to work. It's just going to strengthen the defences. I've been trying to think of this quote, "Tell all the truth, but tell it slant."
Oh, wow.
By Emily Dickinson.
No kidding.
"Tell all the truth, but tell it slant. Success in circuit lies, too bright for our infirm delight, the truth's superb surprise. As lightning to the children eased with explanation kind, the truth must dazzle gradually, or every man be blind."
Just as a selfish human being level, I'm so glad you exist.
Oh, thank you.
Really, a lot. This is going to sound evil from an eco person, but I'm really going to miss the internal combustion engine. We drive cars and they feel good. We like them. And yes, the eco people are coming for our cars. They're coming for our hamburgers. No wonder we don't want to do anything about the environment. It sounds horrible. I don't want to do anything about the environment if it means I've got to completely stop having pleasure. How come we conned ourselves into thinking that being ecological means you can't have any fun anymore? If you think about it, having solar panels means you can have a disco in every room of your house and not feel guilty about it. That's the way to look at it. It's actually like increasing the amount of pleasure you could have rather than decreasing it. The knowledge that other life forms are still alive is a kind of pleasure. If we're going to do this, then we're going to have to find a lot better of a reason to exist than beating up on ourselves for having gotten it wrong. How long can you live just like you're punishing yourself all the time? So I need to get some hope inside me right now. One place it seems to spring from is the recent groundswell of collective activism that's addressing the climate crisis in new ways.
Today we stand together at one of the biggest climate demonstrations the world has ever seen.
We live in an age of extreme individuation. When people do manage to break out of that individuated framing and start to take collective action, as we've seen with the youth strikes, as we've seen with Extinction Rebellion, suddenly you discover your power and you break out of despair. I'm George Monbiot. I'm an environmental journalist and campaigner. Now, I'm constantly being told that the demands of groups like Extinction Rebellion, who are calling, for instance, for zero carbon by 2025, are politically unrealistic. And my response to that is, yes, but anything else is scientifically unrealistic. And political realism is actually a highly flexible thing. Something which seems completely impossible today suddenly seems possible tomorrow. If you look at the extraordinary ructions taking place in UK politics over the past few months, every single one of them was impossible until it happened. But you can't bargain with scientific realism. You can't say, well, let's just suspend the first law of thermodynamics for a few months because it's highly inconvenient. You can't do that. And I think what's happening with collective action is that people are shifting the dial of political realism towards the point of scientific realism, and in doing so, becoming empowered and leaving despair behind. I mean, that's certainly been the case for me.
I'm very, very moved by what you say, and it actually brings to mind a couple of slogans of the old Situationist movement in Paris, those riots in 1968. And one of the slogans that they would scrawl on the walls there was, be realistic, demand the impossible. And so I think we're beginning to make a picture here of how we could talk about the climate crisis in a way that encourages hope rather than despair. We're trying to find a way to ever so slightly even tweak the framework.
Yeah, we just need to tweak that Situationist slogan a tiny bit. It's be scientifically realistic, demand the politically impossible. And we're kind of there, aren't we? That is actually the programme.
We can still fix this. We still have everything in our own hands. Now is the time to speak clearly.
This is what brings up a lot of fear in me. Some of the people moving into this activist space, like Greta Thunberg and Extinction Rebellion Youth, are going to be seen as these perfect angelic beings.
The bigger your carbon footprint is, the bigger your moral duty.
It's not their fault, it's our fault, the media's fault. And so as soon as they do anything remotely compromising, we can stop listening to them. It's like we're allowing someone else to go through the motions for us, like a hero in a Greek tragedy or a priest in a Catholic mass, so that we don't have to, then turning away from them when it goes wrong. It's a way of seeing the darkness as outside of us, as something we can get rid of. I've experienced this myself as a therapy patient, and what I'm learning is that this so-called evil, nasty thing is an interesting phenomenon to explore, and that trying to get rid of it actually makes it more toxic.
I found a very similar thing with my cancer, that I found it very helpful to think of it as a part of myself, that rather than this sort of alien thing from the dark side which had come to get me, it was something to reckon with as part of my being and my personality. And in that way, I was able to incorporate it in a way that didn't cause despair at all. I just saw it not as a battle I had to fight, but as a challenge I had to absorb. And, I was lucky I was successfully treated, but I think it helped me get through that immensely, not to see this as some chiliastic battle between good and evil, but just as a series of negotiations with myself.
Oh, hello there. We're here for the ship channel tour.
Okay.
We have a reservation. Time to face the darkness in us and the darkness in our world.
Due to the war effort, today the Port of Euston is home to the world's second largest petrochemical complex.
For hardcore fans of Tolkien, I suppose this is the Fields of Ithilien, and Mordor is faintly visible on the skyline of various tubes, of various gigantic metallic chemistry sets. Some of them are flaming, like the Eye of Sauron.
We're 52 miles from the Gulf of Mexico in the open sea.
Imagine that you're looking at something that would make you do the face that Martin Sheen does in Apocalypse Now when they're going up into Cambodia. He's got this sort of open-mouthed, what on earth, WTF face. These huge, vast alien things are real. They're part of our world. They're why we have calculators, it's why we can get from A to B, it's why we have certain kinds of food, and we're part of them. On a daily basis, I try to forget this stuff that runs my world, and then I try to forget that I forgot it. So I erase it, and then I erase the erasure. So whenever I encounter it, it's exactly what some psychoanalytical people call the return of the repressed. How to make yourself big enough on the inside to
to be able to cope and not just be burned out or just shocked that you've suddenly seen the underside of your world. If we give space to our personal experiences of this, whether it's in private or in public, maybe we can start to get on with something better for ourselves and the planet. Getting familiar with our feelings about the biosphere we live in, gently, little by little, is what ecological awareness is. A realization that, in a way, the end of the world has already happened. This doesn't mean that we're all doomed. I'll explain more next time and start to explore how we might get to grips with the terrifying scale of the climate crisis.
I see your smoke rising in the air. 2, 3 in the morning when you think no one is there. In the still of the night, my child starts to sneeze. In the still of the night, the other starts to wheeze. Your bright, bright torch, it burns all night. To find my way through the house, I don't even need a light. The roar of your flame I've learned to ignore, even though its combustion vibrate my feet up on the floor. I know I live at the back end of town and I should just be quiet and not make a sound. You might even find this a little profound, but me and my neighbors are a light and dark shade of brown. I hope our leaders don't conspire to circumvent, because these findings I have a sulfur benzene scent. Excuse me while I cough. My throat has a slight tickle. The air I breathe, it smells, and sometimes very fickle. If you went to take a bath and saw a rash up on your chest, would you just shrug your shoulders and wish yourself the best? Because this money they give is great, and this is only flesh. But if you had the right insurance, you could go and take a test. Oh, I'm scared I'll lose my job if the pollution I contest. But if you died tonight, would your killers confess to the poison they put inside you that laid you down to rest? Would your family have to fight to pay your doctor bills as you lay 6 foot under up on a grassy hill? Now your job is gone and your company grievance has faded. Your spouse and kids tried to collect from them, but they said your death was not job related. My toxic reality, my toxic reality, my toxic reality.